This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
All right, let's light this thing up. Doc O'Neill, if you haven't heard what's going on in Baltimore, I really just please Google it and get caught up and then come right back to us because we just don't have time to explain everything. I have next to me, as I always do every week, Dr. Mike O'Neill. And it came to my attention. You said you were a cop. And I'm like, okay, yeah, he was a cop. I get it. You were a Baltimore cop.
Yeah, I was.
Are you kidding me? Seriously, I learned that. I think you were on the Bruce St. James show. That's actually where I heard that. And I about crashed my car.
I'm like, KTR, I've
been,
that's good.
I do. How many years have we been together? Now I learn it's Baltimore. It takes this to learn. So what? How did this impact you?
A long time ago. And it obviously this... You know, it rung a lot of historical chimes, and I tried to put a lot of it in perspective. And my year as a cop in Baltimore was early 70s.
Okay.
And I've read some things said. By the way, let me say a point. This is not, I think if you think this is only about Baltimore, think again. Okay. There's things that are going on, and we've got Paul Penzone here, former Phoenix police officer. We can talk about the extent to which some of this may or may not apply in Phoenix. But if you think it's only Baltimore, I think you missed the point.
Okay.
In fact, and if you think it's only now, you may miss the point. I think that there were a lot of riots in the 60s and a lot of subsequent research done about underlying causes and things like that. And the basic theme is that when marginalized communities feel that they've been brutalized by the police, you tend to get riots. They don't happen all the time. They take precipitating events. But if you think that this is only caused by one single event, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
They're precipitating events that
we're seeing a handful of them now.
Right. And that's why you see it in some other places as well. It's a fair question. Is it everywhere or to what extent? But one of the interesting pieces that I ran across recently was actually was an interview done with David Simon. David Simon was a Baltimore reporter who worked for many years in Baltimore. He subsequently became a screenwriter, and he's the author of The Wire.
Oh, good for him.
By the way, I think most people that I've seen is possibly the best thing that was ever done for television.
Five-year
story and just fascinating stuff. And I read an extended interview that was done with him. And among the things he mentioned, he says in 1965, this goes way back even prior to my time, the few black officers on the force faced overwhelming racism within the department, and a study not by some university liberal group, okay, but by the International Association of Chiefs of Police found that Baltimore had one of the most antiquated and corrupt relationships, almost non-existent relationship to the black community.
And when was this again?
That was 65. I want to tell you that I was there 72, 73. And I would say that was a fair characterization of what I observed. I was, first of all, in a city that then was 50% black. The department was probably 95% white and 99-point-some-odd percent male, by the way. That was part of the – those numbers have evolved. The police department's half black now. The city's 75% black.
I know you have some stats to get to, but I don't want to just brush over that.
Sure.
Because we hear it all the time now. We're hearing 50% black community and a 90% white police force. Is that – that's running under – and it might be the media doing it, but that's running under the assumption that all the white cops hate the black people and all the black people hate the white cops. That's running as if that's a bad stat. That's a bad stat only if there's conflict between each of those whites versus blacks, correct?
Let me talk about some of the stuff that Simon talked about occurring.
Okay.
And again, I didn't see this. He's talking about the 80s and 90s. That's after my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see this – so pointedly, but I will say that the way he described it kind of rang true to me. In other words, I wasn't there. It was years after I left, but it rang true to me. And a lot of it he relates to is the way they approached the drug trade. basically, drugs became a huge issue in the 80s and 90s. And basically, the message went out to the police to say, listen, we just got it. We got to start rounding people up. A joke that he told, and again, I didn't see this, but I tell you, it was consistent with the kind of stuff I did. You know what probable cause is on Edmonston Avenue, which is sort of part of the black community? You roll by in a radio car and guy looks at you for 2 seconds too long. That's probable cause. And then he describes that the city council passed an ordinance declaring drug-free zones, which amounted to about a third of the city. And basically, it was open season on loitering, and anybody looked at you wrong. Mass arrest, okay? I'm going to talk about the racial thing, and there's something where I did make an observation. I observed a norm in the police department. When you came on and you were a minority, there was a question of loyalty. Whose side are you on? Okay, are you with
almost
the
like
police?
A prison mentality almost.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, who are you with? Yeah,
Who side are you on?
Sure.
And I saw black officers sort of held in a little bit of, you had to prove yourself that you were on the police side, you know, and it was like police against the minority community, okay? And you had to prove where your loyalties were. And when you had black officers, particularly black officers working in predominantly white units, and when you had 95% white, almost all black officers worked in predominantly white units. Mm-hmm. Though I subsequently worked in one of the few that was predominantly black, and it was interesting. But when you had black officers working in predominantly white influence, there was pressure on them to prove their loyalty. And you often saw more harsh treatment of citizens, minority citizens, by black officers than by white officers. Simon goes on to even discuss this. He says, when the pressure was on the police department to engage in aggressive activities, the black officers sort of had free hand because it was sort of like a free pass about a discrimination charge, whereas a white officer had to have some degree of constraint because of the suspicion that could be held in them that they're engaged in racial profile or racial related activities.
Right. But I mean, if you look at the state that you I'm sorry, if you look at the national stats from coast to coast, mm-hmm. you can't deny that there is a skew. You can look at the numbers. You can see the racial disparity in both stops and arrests, everything. There is.
And he makes the point, though, that this can be the driving force doesn't have to be race to get you that result. If you're saying, you know, we got to stop certain kind of crime, and here's where the neighborhoods are, here's where the drugs are, and you look at who lives there, you can have that result.
Well, we are a local radio station, so I want to bring in our local guy. I want to bring in Paul Penzone because I want to talk about this on a local level. We'll do that right after this break. It's the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I want to bring in Paul Penzone, a retired police officer from the city of Phoenix, who ran against Joe Arpaio last time. But I want to ask you about one thing specifically.
I'm looking forward to shaking that label one day. If that's all I'm known for, I better get to work.
That does kind of stick in you. It's name word association.
Yeah, I'd like to own it as if it's more about me, but I know that's not the case. Yeah.
I was talking about some of the observations of David Simon, and then the ones very pointed to the recent situation in Baltimore. And again, I didn't see this specifically, but it kind of rang true with what I observed in the culture of the police department in Baltimore. And he said two things get your backside kicked faster than anything else. One is making a cop run, and two, the other one is if you fight. And they had something that I hadn't specifically seen, but it really, you know, rang a bell in terms of the Freddie Gray situation. He said they put you in the paddy wagon and they have what they called a, quote, rough ride. Okay. You know, you get some bumps. You don't get seatbelts or whatever. And I read that piece and I said, well, you know, that's plausible that that's what could have happened there. Was that rough ride that just got out of hand?
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's tough to tell because I've had to speak on this issue before with Mr. Gray. It's hard to determine if what injuries were sustained prior to paddy wagon and what injuries were sustained after the paddy wagon. And I know the autopsy came out with some findings that they believe on how it occurred, but regardless, it's obvious that there was behavior that is, I mean, questionable would be the baseline to start from that led to this outcome. Mm-hmm. But these problems are so much deeper and broader than just simplifying. And you'd mentioned earlier, you talked about, you know, this didn't happen with this incident. You know, and oftentimes, you know, what we see is an incident that is the flashpoint. And by all accounts, that incident might not even be as severe. It's everything that preceded
Ferguson
it.
Ferguson is a good example of that. The investigation of that showed that that turned out that individual case was not out of line, but the behaviors in that department, by the way, I talked to a friend who is from the St. Louis area. He said it was well known in the whole St. Louis community that they were out driving revenues.
Sure.
The police department in Ferguson was given marching orders to basically do all kinds of traffic harassment for purposes of raising revenue for the town. Even though, as I said, the flashpoint incident when investigation essentially was exonerated.
Sure. And it's because of years of either mistrust or all these other factors. And I don't think that you can ever just point the finger and say it is solely the responsibility here. Because when you talk about law enforcement failures, and oftentimes you see them in places where it's older towns, older cities, and they've gone through bumps and bruises and all that kind of growth. That's why with Phoenix right now, it's not that we don't have challenges. We have challenges, but we're still relatively young compared to what you see on the backside of the East Coast and other places. Like if you talk about Chicago, you talk about Baltimore, you talk about Cleveland, they've gone through different cyclical issues. They've gone through different hiring booms. They've gone through all kinds of leadership or political implications. They've gone through racial issues. That Phoenix, we may have those challenges, but nowhere near the extent of what we've seen in other places. Like I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. And there were racial problems there. It was completely different. So it exists everywhere, but oftentimes in some of those older communities, they've been going through for so long in these different cycles that it's led to this, all of a sudden it's just combustible.
You also have sometimes changing demographic patterns that make what would appear to be an indefensible profile of police department actually a product of that change. For example, I remember once seeing a study in Detroit, and the department was way whiter than the community. But somebody went back and looked at it, said every year, if the police that were hired that year exactly mirrored the population at that time, that the police department that you got would be exactly what you had.
Sure.
In other words, the town got blacker, but of course you don't rehire your police department every year.
I believe there's natural bias in all hiring. It's not just law enforcement. It is all walks of life, and it has a lot to do with all different factors. You know, how you could be the most talented, skilled, but if you don't present properly, if you don't look the right way, whatever it may be, there's that human element that always plays. And law enforcement has a challenge with that. But I think you have to really look at other factors and say, how are you recruiting? You know, I want to know how many minorities actually apply and go through the process to be hired. In other words, do you have a proportionate number, but you're just still hiring whiter than you are to the minority category? And I would be willing to guess that that is the case because it is just a reflection of our society, unfortunately.
Let me throw one thing.
But we need to do a better job of identifying where the root cause is and then finding solutions to develop those areas.
Let me throw one thing into the mix in that regard. Something that would seem to be a good idea when you're hiring a police officer, you would like somebody with a very clean arrest record.
With very little life experience?
Right. Well, here's...
because
yeah,
you,
yeah. Here's the point.
It's tough to
the
do.
Point is, if you grow up in a lower-class neighborhood and there's aggressive policing and a whole lot of policing arrests for status offenses, curfew, loitering, I'm not talking burglaries and robberies. I'm talking just sort of the normal kid stuff
being
in certain neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Right, being a kid in certain neighborhoods.
It's all you know.
And if you are excluding from the police force people based on that, then there's going to be a racial and a class bias.
Absolutely. So, you know, a big part of it, and there's no one answer to that. There's no magic pill. But as a police officer, you know, they use the term community-based policing too often. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, at least from my perspective, we look at it in operational ways or in policy and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, it's standing in front of another person, man, woman, child, whomever it may be, and getting to know them on a personal scale, even though you have a responsibility to carry out laws and other things, but to see them as a human. You have to have that human element that you actually care that this is a person. And if they break the law or do whatever it is that they do, you have a responsibility to carry out and enforce those laws. But if you don't see them as a human and to start with, then it's a lot easier to remove yourself and enact in manners or to be judgmental in a subjective fashion.
Tell me about Phoenix. Is that
sunny
Phoenix
every
Police
day.
Department? I'm talking about community relations in Phoenix. Could we have a flashpoint like Baltimore, do you think?
I don't think like Baltimore because I don't know that we have any one particular area. You know, you have to have an area where the that you have a volume of people who all not only are unfortunately dealing with maybe unfair treatment, but feel some form of a connection. I still see this area, although you can look at certain and see a reflection of particular ethnicities in certain areas, it's so transient here. Mm-hmm. So how do you, like in Baltimore, that community that's, you know, behaved badly, but because the circumstances they felt were justifiable, mm-hmm. that was in their way a community of in and of itself. I don't know that we have that yet in Phoenix. Does that mean we can't get there? No, absolutely. We can go in that direction. I see challenges right now. Like one of the things I think is a factor.
I mean, if there's something, it'd be immigration sweeps.
Yeah, it would be an immigration sweep where people came for an organized event and then it spilled over into what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But the abuse type thing that we've seen in Baltimore that led to this, I don't see that in Arizona right now or in Phoenix. But here's where I see the challenge. There are challenges or problems with individual officers or individual groups of officers in particular areas. And we went through a cycle of like a hiring boom. There's a hiring boom, then a hiring dip. Mm-hmm. And we had the hiring dip recently with the economy. But there was a time, I would tell you, probably the 80s, hiring boom, ton of officers coming through the door. Then you had this huge dip. So what you get is a discrepancy in experience. So when I first became a sergeant, I had 12 people on my squad, which already span of control is too high. You usually want to have about 8 because you want to be able to manage at that level. But I had 12, and I think my senior officer had 3 years on. So a staff of 12, they have nobody other than the sergeant with experience, and you can't be everywhere at all times. So you need people who are making sound decisions, that are their peers, that are out there in the field. And when you have these peaks and valleys, you create almost like a generation of officers that maybe aren't performing the manner that they should because they don't have the leadership that they need.
We have Paul Penzone here. He's helping us out. We have former Baltimore PD right here, Dr. Mike O'Neill. We're getting down to the bottom of the discrepancy, or so we see maybe, in policing. In the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, Mike O'Neill talking here with Mike Russell, talking to Paul Penzone, formerly of the Phoenix Police Department. I want to hearken back to some of the things that this Simon interview, the Wire author and former reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He talked about the evolution of things in Baltimore, and he was very, very critical, accurate, among other things, of Martin O'Malley and basically the political structure, and said that basically O'Malley wanted to reduce the crime rate, and he brought in a new police chief, and the first year they did some stuff right, and they had an impact, and then O'Malley just put pressure for more and more and more, and then they started junking.
They just cooked the books.
Basically cooking the books.
Yeah.
Now, Phoenix, one thing's different. We have a council manager form of government where it is supposedly illegal for a mayor or even a council member to give a direct order to any city official, and it's supposed to insulate us from exactly those kinds of political pressures. In your experiences, does that work here?
I wouldn't say that it's flawless because I would tell you that law enforcement, I'm not speaking now, let's go back, say, 10 years. You know, and we had, you know, a flashpoint, I guess you could use that term again, 9/11. After 9/11, because of the tragedies and what occurred and those things would be described as heroism, law enforcement was beloved, probably more time than ever, okay, and firefighters. And during that time, anything you did in law enforcement, it became top of the fold. You know, in the newscast, all these positive stories were going, all these kinds of things were occurring. What you saw... And I can speak firsthand because I was running Silent Witness, so I was directly involved in the media and doing a lot of things. You saw that a lot of people that were in public office, elected officials, for better or for worse, oftentimes with good intentions, wanted to align with law enforcement. If there was a news conference there in the background, if there was something going on, they were out there. So whether it was intentional or not, indirect or direct, they were influencing decisions or outcomes. Because when an elected official walks out there and the police chief or whomever sees that, their behavior changes a little bit. Now, all of a sudden, we need to make sure we address this issue for this particular reason. So I think it would be naive to say that politics does not influence, even in the current design that we have here, influence decisions or outcomes within the law enforcement world. And they shouldn't. You know, that should not be the case. But I just think that it is, we're in this reality TV world and everybody wants their snapshot.
There's one other thing that I think can influence things immensely. And it was described in this interview, and it's very different from what they clearly had changed the system. When I was an officer in the early 70s in Baltimore, when you had to go to court on your day off, you got paid a flat rate of $7. Okay. By the 80s, they had changed that system because the $7 was probably illegal according
to the
labor.
That's equivalent to like a paper boy back in those
days.
Yes,
yes. Okay. $7 for going to court and you can sit there for half a day. They changed the system and everybody's getting overtime pay. And so the point he makes, if you ran around making a lot of status offense, really BS kinds of arrests.
That's how you were going to make your money.
You could double your salary.
It's no different now.
But he contrasted that with an officer's really doing their job. They spend a week. They break a big case. They go to court once. In other words, the guys that are filling the courts with BS, little low-level arrests, they're doubling their salary because they're in court all the time.
And their statistics look better.
And you're running lots of arrests, but not for the kind of stuff that makes the community any safer. The guy who works his tail off, and when you arrest a burglar for one offense.
Yeah, you cleared 30.
You cleared 30, or you're taking one guy off the street.
You're preventing who's gonna, the next 30.
Which is even more important than clearing him. Because you get a guy for one. Most people are doing that sort of thing or in it as a career. And it's a relatively small number of people that do a lot of crimes. If you get the right guys, you're doing immensely. But the reward structure is absolutely wrong.
And I don't know that it's any different now, unfortunately, because a lot of officers, and I'm not saying I hope that's not the motivation for their decisions, but you'd have to believe with human nature there are some who know that the more arrests I make, the more I'm going to be in court, the more I'm in court because of my schedule, the more overtime I'm going to make, the more money I'm going to make for my retirement. But there were a couple things in his article that I did not agree with. The first one, I shouldn't say I didn't agree with because I don't know what it's like in Baltimore, but I can tell you here in Phoenix that your statistical record, like what we're referring to now, has nothing to do with the decision for whether or not you'll be promoted. Mm-hmm. The promotion system here is strictly academic. You have to take a written test and it goes through all policies and procedures. They will look through your file to make sure there's no discipline that you've walk the walk and talk the talk. And then there's an oral board process, which could have some subjectivity, but ultimately they try to create a formula where there are certain trigger points that you get points for these particular answers and knowing these certain things. Now, for the first few levels, that's how promotions occur. Then when you get to about the commander level, it's more so you do have to pass a test, but then you're selected based off the merits that the chief believes best suit the need. So there he talked about it solely being promotions based off of making as many arrests as possible. Mm-hmm. Not the case here. The other issue that I had with him, and I've worked in narcotics for a long time, he talked a lot about the things that you mentioned earlier about the war on drugs, how it was the impetus for all this, and treat it as though just eliminate any issue with drugs. I'm not going to take that position because it'll be like the election. There's going to be 51% want to beat me up and therefore 49% agree with me. At the end of the day, there are other collateral issues that come from the drug problem. If you talk about meth, you talk about cocaine, you talk about some of the more severe drugs and even legalized ones like OxyContin. Addiction, mental illness, violence, all these other factors bleed over, okay, into society. So you can't say, let's just legalize and get rid of this war on drugs and not recognize that drug addiction is the I don't know which is symptomatic, but at the end of the day, there's collateral issues that come from that problem, and you can't ignore those. So violence in society oftentimes is precipitated by alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and other factors. So as an officer, you still got responsibilities. It's a matter of first-line management doing a better job of making sure your men and women are doing the job the right way.
I guess the question would be, is that a police issue or is that a medical issue?
I think it's both. No. I don't think we're looking for this, okay, we got one sword and we're going to eliminate the problem. No, it's multiple factors. It is medical. It is criminal. It is psychological. It is educational. It is socioeconomic. There's all lanes that apply to that place. So if you're going to try to address that issue, you can't just go, all right, we're going to make more laws and that's going to fix the problem.
Well, I remember Richard Nixon declared war on drugs in 1969. We've had an enforcement approach and it hasn't really gotten us anywhere in 45 years.
Listen, live story. I was at the mall just a few days ago, standing in line. I see this couple looking at me and, sometimes it's like, I don't know, are they mad at me? Is it something, they could be all, do I know them personally, professionally, whatever. I never know. So I'm just very cautious. And they walk up and the guy says, hey, how you doing? He goes, I don't know if you remember me or not. And he tells me his name and it doesn't click with me. And he says, jokingly, he goes, you put me through college. And I'm like, excuse me. I said, I apologize. I said, you're gonna have to refresh my memory. Where do I know you from? So it takes a couple of explanations and finally it clicks with me. I had arrested him when I worked in narcotics. He told me, he's like, and he goes, you know what? He basically said, you doing that, you gave me an education that changed the course of my life. He told me what he did now professionally. His wife was with him. He's healthy. He's married. He's got a family and everything. And I don't take credit for it, but I was humbled that the last thing he said to me, he said, when I see you on TV or something, he goes, first and foremost, I'm disappointed I couldn't vote for you because I lost my right to vote.
Oh.
And then he said, but I tell people, Paul Pinzon is a classy person. He treated me with respect. So I don't say that to brag on myself, but I go back to it and I look at, you know, that was a person when I dealt with the situation, I tried to be professional. And then when you see it on the back end and they're doing well for themselves, I would much rather see that than a person who's incarcerated mm-hmm. and can't get it right.
Yeah. It's clear that rewards and punishment can influence police behavior a lot. I remember that this is on the drug case. Now, when I was there, there was an incident with some drugs missing out of the police property room.
I'm sure that never happened.
I'm going to plug my ears and go, no, 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 because I don't know if I want to.
Well, I'll tell you what happened.
I don't want to be a witness to what's going on right now.
Commissioner issued a 60-page document outlining the procedures that the police were to follow through anytime they came in contract with any drugs. And this was read for a week in roll call, at the end of which our sergeant took us aside privately and said, listen, we don't have time for this. So if you see any drug-related activity, you take a dime and you call the narcotic squad and you let them deal with it.
Okay, do we have time for one? I want to.
You know something? I'm going to hold you over. Can you give us 10 more minutes?
Yeah, because I want to ask you something.
Okay. Uh-oh. See, now I'm going to be in the hot seat. That's whatever Paul Pinzon has loaded up for me. It's coming up next right here on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back here with Paul Pinzon. He wants to ask Mike Russell a question. Go for it.
Oh, yeah, I want to turn the tables. I always get the questions fired at me. So if you're willing to share, or even if it never happened, you can make up a hypothetical.
Sure.
Good contact with a police officer, bad contact with a police officer. Just the circumstances.
Good contact with a police officer. Yeah, traffic stops are really all I've had. I'll throw that out there. Inside of one event that we don't have to get any details.
We don't have to go
deal with Long Beach PD, so I don't think they can hear this far. But traffic stops, really. Honesty, calm, cool. The officer was very upfront with his intentions and why he stopped me. It was a search that was going on in a neighborhood, so I was stopped for no real reason. And, you know, I could have gone all libertarian on him and am I being detained and blah, blah, blah. He just came he was very professional. He was very upfront. He was very courteous. And it stayed with me the rest of the day. He thanked me for just participating and, you know, making his job easier because I've never been in that spot. I don't want to be in that spot. I let him be in that spot. And then a bad, you know, same everyone else has had. I was picked on. Everyone was doing one thing. And then some guy signaled me out and was a complete jerk to me.
So my point is, in both those circumstances, it sticks with you. Like if I said, give me an example of somebody at a grocery store who, you know, the cashier wasn't nice to you.
Right.
The likelihood of that sticking with you, you could dig deep and find it. But those are significant moments in our life. We remember, even I'm a cop. And if I were to get pulled over and the lights going behind me, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. And I can tell you, and I don't share this often because I don't think it's relevant. You know, it shouldn't be. In this case, I guess it is. In my family, you know, in different capacities, I have family members who are minority, okay, in different minority categories. And so oftentimes I'll see things through their eyes. And I do know, in that case, there are some times when this is going to sound terrible, but one particular person, we say, listen, if you get stopped, don't be afraid to turn your phone on, okay? And I've had circumstances where officers, and I know this because I've done it, just the manner they went about the treatment, not that they said anything specific, didn't use profanity like that, but the tone of the conversation or the tone of the contact was very condescending, was very aggressive, and unnecessarily so. That is still less common, okay? I will tell you, it's less common. It's more common that the officers are professional. But I worry for that, as terrible as that sounds, because bad day, misinterpretation, whatever it may be, and we need to get away from that. We shouldn't fear those things. We got to get back to a place where we have confidence and trust in law enforcement, and we're not more worried about how they're going to mistreat us, and we know because we see it and we feel it that they're doing their job the right way. But I feel it on a personal scale, and I came from the side of law enforcement, and I worry for it not because I think most cops are bad. I think most cops are good. But we see too many examples now
of
cops.
Most cops are good.
Yes. Well, right. It should be the standard.
Mm-hmm.
But all cops are human.
Right.
So how do you manage the circumstances and how do you deal with those who don't deserve to wear the badge?
Let me pursue that because there's one thing, and I think it's pretty darn universal in police culture. And that is sort of the phenomena of sticking together. So you're on the street and you observe somebody, another officer, doing something they shouldn't be doing, right? The norm is you never, never rat out a brother officer. And even note that term, brother officer, which I assume is pretty universal. Is that an accurate characterization? And if so, does it create an issue in terms of, sort of the credibility of when there's an allegation that somebody's done something out of line and he's backed up by all his feather officers? I wonder if that doesn't make, the public a little less inclined to believe because of that phenomenon.
I think it's inherent in the work that is done, because when you go out on the street and all of a sudden you're in a fight with somebody who is a bad person, and the one who comes to your aid might be something that you don't eat. The funny thing about law enforcement, listen, if you want to be loved, go be a firefighter. They eat together, they work out together, they sleep together, as far as I can tell.
And nobody ever has a negative encounter with a fireman.
So if you want to be loved, be
there. If they come, you're wanting help.
And they go on a call for a little lady or something, and there's 17 guys on the truck, and they're all three times my size. And I'm envious, okay? I'm not dogging them, right? Isn't it true? They travel together. In law enforcement, the funny thing is there's almost like a competitive, it's almost like siblings who love each other but don't really like each other. I can't believe you got that arrest. That was BS, whatever, or whatever it may be.
They're
almost
step siblings.
Yeah, everybody's competing.
Yeah. And
at the same time, when you're getting in a fight and you're getting thumped and the person you might not even really like that much all of a sudden is there to bail you out, and they're the ones keeping you from, getting hurt badly.
And you're very aware of that.
Yeah. So you have this baseline of loyalty to each other because of those circumstances. Yeah. But
now, that your safety is
dependent,
a function
on them.
Of the guys you're working with.
And you can't get away from that, because at the end of the day, there are a lot of bad people out there, and that's what law enforcement tries to focus on, those bad people who wish to do us harm. So how do you get to the place where you realize that the officer who's acting badly reflects on what you committed to and who you are, and it's not so much about ratting, it is about holding accountable and setting the standard higher. It has to be our expectation if you're in this department is we work at this level, and this level is high. Okay, not just the how hard we work, but how serious we are about doing the job the right way. But when that fiber gets torn apart, it's hard to rebuild it. And that's why you can't fall asleep at the wheel. You have to hold that line day in, day out.
That seems to me that is a real, real tough task, really, for leadership.
Absolutely.
To establish that there's standard, that there's going to be high standards here. And we're all in that together.
So I came in under a chief named Ruben Ortega, and at that time you could not cohabitation where you couldn't live with your significant other unless you were married.
Hmm.
And if you did, you were terminated.
Wow.
Those are the types of things that, that's how the standard was. Now, obviously, it's
also late 70s.
Society has changed, but I use that as an extreme example, but it wasn't just that. Right now, I think short of... It used to be if you lied, you got fired. If you there were certain things that would get terminated right away. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where the line is anymore, and I don't know how it got off of where it was. Some of it is societal. We have to adapt. Other things should never change. They are just the baseline of the values of what law enforcement represents. So those are things that you got to hold true.
But I want everyone to understand this, if from the non-cop in the room, that nationwide, the amount of arrests stops, and I'm going backwards, I'll start with stops, arrests, and the like, every day, that happen every hour of every day of every week of every month of every year, are so many, and we get to judge these police officers by the few that we end up seeing, unfortunately, on the media. This is, this is my belief, and I hope you guys can back me, by and large, most cops, good cops.
Right now, there's a cop out there doing something that truly is heroic, and you'll never hear the story.
Exactly. Thank you.
And there's just right here in Phoenix, there's people wearing body armor in 100 degrees and going out there every day and trying to keep our community safe, men and women of all walks of life doing a good job. We're talking about the issues that just rise above the fold. And at the end of the day, listen, I'm always going to take pride in what I did and those who are doing it now. And we should all feel that way, but we just have to do a better job of holding not only law enforcement accountable, our elected officials accountable, our city managers accountable, everybody, because they're the ones empowered to do the job on our behalf to make sure things are done right.
But until until you have put yourself in those shoes, until you have pulled a car over not knowing who or what is inside and walked to that car not knowing what kind of attitude, what kind of day they're having, what kind of weapon they might have, until you've gone in those shoes, please, that's my public service announcement. Please stop judging until you've stepped in those shoes. And we've seen people recently, very vocal people recently, Jared Maupin, get into some types of simulators and shoot unarmed people or get shot themselves.
I didn't know that happened. That's interesting.
Oh, yes, it did. I take no joy in it.
Question. This is an old one, but it gets to a lot of these issues. How do you feel about civilian review boards?
I don't have any problem with civilian. As a matter of fact, I think that I think there's a place to have a third party, almost like is it ombudsman? Is that the correct term? Where it might not be that you have full authority, but just by the mere makeup of that board, it is an influential board with the right intentions. You know, it has to be handpicked and diverse of all different types of skill sets, as well as different races and religions, everything. But I do think that the community. Having an opinion and having influence in some manner for the best interest should work in both directions. It shouldn't just be over law enforcement. It should be that, let's say we had a problem here in a particular area or community, whatever it is, and it's heading the direction like in Missouri. Mm-hmm. That group has to be able to go out there and say, hey, let's get our minds straight on how we're going to solve this problem, not just how we're going to be disruptive, because mm-hmm. disruption doesn't always lead to a solution. It seldom does.
You know, I'll extend that. I think that a broader review is appropriate to many groups. I, for example, remember doing focus groups with groups of physicians who privately will tell you, they will admit, we haven't done a very good job of policing ourselves.
Sure.
And it's because of the same sort of fraternal. We're protecting all of ourselves. And I think there is no group that should be immune from external review by fair-minded individuals of broad perspective. And I know in the case of police, they said, well, we shouldn't have extra because we're professionals. My response to that is outside groups should review everybody.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this, though. I sleep well at night knowing men and women are out there in uniform
to
keep me safe.
And thank you for what you've done and what you continue to do. Doc, thank you for what you did. You cop, you check you out. On behalf of Doc O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell, KTAR News.